It's Sunday, September 15th, 2013, and welcome to episode 58 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go,
RCR is a podcast about retro computing news, nostalgia, and collecting. I'm Earl Evans, and you're not. With me, as always, is Carrington Vanston, a.k.a. Garth. Party on, Garth.
Party on, Wayne.
Hey, how you doing, man?
So I am doing fantastic.
So we were chatting just before I started the show, and you said that you had driven a long way to play video games.
I went to Chicago this weekend. Yes, I went down to the grand reopening of the Underground Retrocade, it's called, which is in West Dundee. Used to be in East Dundee, then it got flooded out and reopened on Friday in West Dundee. So it opened about maybe 500 steps from where it was before. You walk over a bridge, here's the new place. So it's an arcade. Really, really swell arcade run by a really, really swell fellow. And I want to go down and sort of celebrate the opening. And selfishly, I want to play a whole bunch of classic video games. So.
Well, of course.
Super fun.
How far is that from you?
About 9 hours. Nine or ten hours of driving.
So you're only 9 to 10 hours from Chicago, huh?
Yes.
That's cool.
Probably 8 hours the way other people drive, but I'm a bit pokey.
Well, maybe if I get back there one of these days, I'll have to give you some heads up. Maybe we could meet up. I get to Chicago every now and then for work because that's where our headquarters is.
Oh, yeah, and I go a few times a year as well.
So I guess we should jump into the items of interest.
And do it.
The first one may be a little disappointing for anyone who's actually seeing us right now, but we've come to the end of an era. Yes, folks.
Goodbye. No, kidding.
Yeah. Adios.
No,
we're pulling the plug. We're not pulling the plug, but we are pulling the plug on video. Mm-hmm. I know this is going to stab the heart of those few loyal folks who have watched us on video, and for that I do apologize. However, you're a modest-sized group compared to the folks who listen to us on audio, and Google and YouTube have been doing whatever they can these days to foil us in our efforts to produce a quality program here. They keep moving things around on us, moving our cheese, as I always say. So we're going to be returning to the glory days of radio. And as it turns out, as you've said also, Carrington, I have a face made for radio.
It'll be easier on the production end to go back to a higher quality sounding audio stream as well. So that's a big one for me, is getting back to higher quality audio for our listeners, because the ratio of people who watch the video versus who listen to the audio is something like 2,000 to 1 or something ridiculous. So it's much more important that we focus on giving a very good quality product, I think, for that. And as we're bringing on new host and or hosts, or I'm not letting any cats out of any bags, but as we do that, it also gives a little more flexibility in the recording and in co-hosting and all of that. As the show expands, we'll be making some other format changes and that kind of stuff. So exciting times coming up for the RCR, but one of them will be, yes, the loss of the video. But we will be using the video channel for other things. So,
yes.
Well, we won't just do the live talking head version of our podcast. Instead, on the channel, you will find more interesting videos, I think. So I think it's a win-win for everybody.
Indeed. And I've actually got a set of videos already thought out that I want to upload to the channel.
I have one video thought out.
Pretty close, right off the bat. I've been doing a lot of work with Forth, which I'll talk about at the end of the show when we do the roundtable, but I've got some ideas for that might be fairly exciting for folks, for our retro computing enthusiasts. So
Sweet. The
details will be on a future show, and also, of course, at rcrpodcast.com. So as we work this out, head on over to our website and we'll tell you what's going on. We promise not to leave you in the dust. So on
we won't leave people in the dark. We will leave people in our dust.
That in our vapor trail, as it were.
Eat our vapor.
So I get to choose the topic because I am the host. So
you are the host. What have you got for me?
What can we learn from old computers? Let me explain.
Nothing. Next topic.
I disagree. I disagree vehemently.
You're with me too.
So here's the story. Retro computing is a hobby. It's fun. It's an avocation. It's, you know, in some sense, it's a trivial pursuit. I mean, it's not like we're either going to make billions or change the world dramatically with retro computing.
I got plans.
Well, I've learned never to underestimate you, Carrington.
or to overestimate you. In fact, don't estimate me. No estimating.
But I still think there's a lot of value in learning from old computers and from the history of old computers. A couple of examples. One is, as we've talked about a lot of times, the old computers are simpler. So if you want to get grounded in the, and you know, when I was a kid, I was grounded often. But if you want a good grounding in the fundamentals of computing, much easier to start with a retro computer where you can wrap your brain around the whole thing and understand, wow, these are ones and zeros and this is how they come together. Also, books like Fire in the Valley and the many books about Apple and the Commodore book, what's the name of that again? Something about the Edge, On the Edge, yeah.
On the Edge, yes.
A variety of those books delve into the politics and the business decisions and the interpersonal interactions in these companies. And I've found that a lot of the things that I read about in those books are still true today. I mean, people are people. So it's interesting to get some of the history of the players, but it's also interesting to see some of those things and go, wow, this company or that company are making the same old mistakes all over again. And why are they doing that? Well, because people have their idiosyncrasies. So
they haven't read the books.
You know, you jest, but
I do.
It's true. They haven't read the books. What's that thing that if you don't learn about history, you're doomed to repeat it?
And in summer school.
And
my history teacher used to say that to me all the time. I never heard a student talking about it. I'm doomed.
That's funny. That's funny. But so you, Carrington.
So me.
You.
You, Carrington.
What do you think you can learn from old computers?
I completely agree with you and partially disagree with you. So this should be interesting. So from the agreeing point, I know that I personally learned fundamentals of computing based on earlier systems than even existed when I was first getting into it. Like, I cut my teeth programming in the 8-bit era, and my Apple II was, I think, my fourth computer, but it was the first one I did a lot of coding on, and it was the first one I really loved and really understood. And before that, with the S100 and the Altair and stuff, I did something, because you couldn't use them for anything other than coding. Like, you wanted something, that's all you did, and I was really rudimentary. Mm-hmm. But I learned a lot about how to do that by reading books and working with those logic little logic kits you can get from Radio Shack and electronics kits and yes. I learned a lot of circuit stuff, and so I came from like working with things older and even simpler, like a whole order of magnitude simpler than even the 8-bit stuff was how I got the fundamentals in my head to then work on the 8-bit stuff. And I think that served me very well, and learning a breadth of systems and approaches to computing let me understand the parts that are, you know, computation that are common, there are certain things that are the same to an Atari, to an Apple II, to an iPad, to a mainframe, to an anything. There are some things that they share, the commonality of computing. And I really got to understand that and understand those topics well by learning a breadth of computers. And by playing with lots of them, I got to see, oh, this is the same, and here's what I like, and here's what's different about an Apple II. Here's what's better about an Apple II than other computers. But it did let me understand them at a deep level. And I do think that getting grounded in the basics there by starting with something very fundamental, by starting with here are ones and zeros, here's what a logic gate is, here's the fundamentals of what's going on with a computer, is why I got to become a professional, you know, pay me for my time software developer, and turned me into one of those people that everybody else comes to when they have problems. People that aren't grounded in that are the people that come to me and say, I used to press the red button and now it doesn't work. I'm like, that's because you're focusing on the red button and you don't understand what the red button was doing. And
because there's logic under the hood.
Exactly.
But and it's magic.
Exactly. And I think if you want to be a good computer user, understanding what's going on. It doesn't necessarily make you a programmer. Like, you might not never want to develop software, but you become a heck of a lot better Microsoft Word user if you understand the fundamentals of computers and figure, well, where would Word have hidden this feature, or why doesn't this work, or, and that sort of thing. So I do think getting grounded in basics and in things simpler than the system you're really going to use is a very good approach. And the nice thing is you don't have to go all the way back to these are ones and zeros and this is a logic gate and you can't do anything with it. You could start with something like a Commodore 64 or an Apple II and say, look, this is how a keyboard interacts. Here's how a card works. Here's a computer that you can really understand. It's a nice, simple system. And I think maybe with kids working with stuff like that, working or not even with vintage ones, work with a Raspberry Pi, work with something, work with an Arduino, work with something simple, can really help ground you before you get to your, okay, now here's your 16 gigabyte of memory, vastly, you know, different sort of computer, and it's just a computer. It's just a bigger, faster version of what you were learning on. So there's some good stuff there. I do, on the other hand, I've quibbled. When I was a kid, I used to quibble with the idea that it's better to learn BASIC first versus learning C or versus learning assembler, because, again, I always thought, well, just learn programming and don't get in your head that C is somehow hard and BASIC is somehow easy. They're just different versions of the same thing. Some are more limited than the others, but let's not pretend one's harder. It'll put in kids' mindsets that are harder. So I wouldn't want kids to think, well, modern computers are hard, and so you don't tell your daughter, okay, this is a hard thing, so we're going to start you on an old thing because it's easy, because you have that also that lesson that new is hard. New isn't hard. New is just bigger.
Good
but
point.
I do. I find personal value in old computers, obviously, because I have that nostalgia factor. They appeal to me now, not just for nostalgia. They appeal to me for the same reasons they appealed to me then, and it's for different things than modern computers appeal to me. I don't have the same visceral love for my MacBook Pro that I'm in front of right now recording this podcast. I like the computer very much. I've been an Apple guy forever. It's a wonderful bit of kit that enables me to do tons of non-computer things. I can write with like a podcast, but do all these amazing things that aren't the computer. I'm just using the computer as a tool. It's a fantastic, elegant, wonderful tool that gets out of my way and lets me create stuff. But right to my right here, camera left, I have an Apple IIe. And I know all the circuits, and I know where the bits of memory are that can make an E appear on the screen in a certain position. And
you could have a schematic.
Yeah, and
you
I think
trace
the
actual individual wires.
And I have. And there's something about, I think people that don't get computers but maybe get something else, like if you get cars, people, like I drive a Mazda 3 and I'm like, yeah, whatever. And like I like it. It's a decent enough car. But I don't love it the way somebody who's got a 1972 Barracuda, if that even is a car that exists, so I don't know cars, would love their simpler, non-computerized car that you've built yourself from scratch and you understand every tube in it and everything it does. You can love that kind of car in a way that it's harder to love a modern Toyota. I think it's the same thing with computers.
I completely agree.
Yeah?
I had a 68 Cougar.
Exactly. And I doubt you can love a modern car other than
high-end. Thinking simple.
Car,
I mean, yeah. I actually did some repairs on it myself, and I am not a car guy.
I can change my oil, and that's all I can do. Anything else means I take it to somebody who reads the computer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think there's value in that, and I think it can introduce people, even like kids today, they could learn to love a computer. And I wonder, is that just you learn to love your first computers and they'll love MacBooks the way I won't? But I don't know. But I bet a kid could love a Raspberry Pi in a way that they couldn't love a modern Windows 8 machine. Only because Windows 8, or Windows 7. Windows 8 sucks. No one can love a Windows 8 machine.
Hey, now. So, well, here's the story. So with my daughter, you mentioned my daughter. That's
I mentioned your daughter.
It's a pretty good example because using a modern computer, she likes doing that. Like you said, it's a tool. She gets her homework done. She does that kind of thing. But when we pull out the breadboard and build our own computer, then it's when the eyes sparkle and the, you know, the lights turn on. And it's like, oh my gosh, wow, that is so cool. Or the Raspberry Pi or things like that. Or the stuff with the propeller chip. Or we don't have an Arduino yet, but we want to get one because she keeps seeing them all over the place. She's like,
I'm less keen on those. I'm more of a software guy. So the Raspberry Pi appeals to me more than the Arduino, which seems more for hardware guys.
Yes.
Or girls.
But in any case, cool.
Yeah. But I wonder, is it the case that would she love, is it the creation aspect, though? Like a Raspberry Pi is a, here it is, it's potential in a tiny box, make something of it. It does nothing without making it. In the same way that old computers, here's your Apple II. What's it do? Nothing. Blinking cursor. Ha! You want a game? Make one. And so when you fulfill that challenge, you can really love the thing, the tool that helped you make that. I love my computer much more when I'm developing software on it than when I'm surfing the web, say. So maybe it depends on what you're using the tool for. I don't know. I think there's lots of shades of gray in the topic. I do think, though, there is value in old computers, and not just for old guys like me. I think there is value that it's nuanced value. But I think there's something there. I think old computers have real value beyond just their historical value.
Yep. Me too. Well, cool.
Nice topic, Earl. I like that. That was a good one.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. And because you complimented me, I'll actually let you talk some more. You've got a news story here about the Interstellar 8-track player.
We have sent an 8-track player out of the solar system. Now, most people...
Was there an 8-track player on Voyager?
Voyager 1.
Really? I didn't know that.
Me neither. I only found
Gordon
that out.
Lightfoot on Voyager 1.
Exactly. I never knew this either, but I only... Because... 8-track or the Voyager 1, and talk about old computer tech. So Voyager 1 has just left our solar system, and these are the kind of things that still excite me. I'm still excited about space. I'm still disappointed that we went to the moon, and we don't seem to think we can't be arsed to go back.
Yeah,
it drives me crazy.
Me too.
I get that there's problems here. Oh, but I know I don't think there's every other problem in the world.
My son is studying the 60s right now, and he just watched the first three of the series When We Left Earth, narrated by Gary Sinise. It's a very good series, by the way.
When We Left Earth, back when we could leave Earth.
Yes, and we did leave Earth. And I was watching that with him, and I was just getting goosebumps. I was like, yep. Those were the days. Anyway,
I want to go off planet. I want to go to Mars. And I get one-way ticket. Okay, sure, great. Mars, please, anywhere.
Pioneers. We need some pioneering.
So when I think of, you know, exciting tech from the 80s and 70s, one of the things is space tech. And Voyager 1 is as cool as space tech gets, I guess. And it has left the... is the first man-made object to get into interstellar space. So it's actually left our solar system. And it took a long time to do that, but it gives you a sense of how big our solar system really is. So all this time, it has been traveling since 1977. So Star Wars came out, we launched a thing. Star Wars now sucks, but Voyager is still going.
Voyager rocks. Yeah. Some of the stuff on that thing still work after all this time.
Amazing, eh? So there is an... what I didn't know about Voyager. It's amazing that I can still be learning something about Voyager. Like a kid who was so into space stuff and still is. And I did not know that there is an 8-track recording system on Voyager 1 that collects data and stuff, and that's part of what they're using. And they say it's got a probe attached to it, and the probe is the size of a car. This probe detects vibrations and vibrations of excited plasma, I think. And so just... these things, you forget like how big it is, that it has a probe the size of a car attached to it.
I didn't know that Voyager 1 was that huge.
Me neither. I think of it as this little tiny thing.
Right.
It's like, no.
Voyager seeks the creator.
Yes. So it has an 8-track player attached to a probe the size of a car, and it has left our solar system. And I don't think there can be a cooler bit of 1970s tech news than that this week. So I want to kick it off with that, because I'm so proud of us as humanity. Look at us leaving our solar system.
Shooting out 8-tracks and golden records.
Exactly. The aliens will judge us by our tech. They were clearly into disco.
That's funny. Oh, I hope they don't. Well, anyway. Don't judge us by our disco.
Now, it's left the solar system proper, and right now it takes 23 years for what it broadcasts to get back to us. Like, that's how, because it keeps going farther and farther and increasing this distance for it to communicate. So as it sends a package of info today, it'll be 23 years from now.
Not before years, it arrives. Right? It can't be 23 light years out.
It's 23... No, it isn't. Sorry, I'm mixing it up. It was 23 years before it left the factory. I've got all these things in my head, all this bits of information that I've been learning this year. I did learn that it's going to be 30,000 years before it leaves the true, complete edge of the solar system. So it's left what we consider our real solar system.
It's past the termination shock. It's past the heliopause.
Exactly. But there are things that circle our sun, like distant comets. Mm. And before Voyager 1 gets farther out than anything to do with our solar system, it'll be 30,000 years.
Holy cow.
So it's got a ways to go.
I'm going to be really old.
Yeah. And it's currently going 38,000 miles an hour. But since miles don't mean anything to me, that speed means nothing.
It's really fast. It's like 1,000,000 kilometers per hour, I think.
I don't know how long it'll take. Voyager 2, I don't know how long it's... I know it's a few years from now before it'll breach this part of the solar system. It'll become interstellar, but I don't know how many years. 2, 3, something like that. So.
And I would be curious, actually, what kind of computing technology is on Voyager 1?
It's an Apple II.
It would have been one of the first ones off the assembly line.
Apple II the size of a car is what it is. So anyway, I just find it all so exciting, and I just get giddy and childlike with anything to do with it. So
I completely agree, and I'm betting that with the listeners to this podcast, you're preaching to the choir too. Preach it, brother.
Preach on. So what have you got to possibly compete against that? Interstellar objects. What have you got for me?
I can't follow that. I'm going to talk about a search engine, but it's actually pretty cool. CBM8bit.com has had search for Commodore. Now they've got search for Amiga stuff as well. Sure. So if you're looking for stuff regarding Commodore, and now that includes 8-bit or Amiga, you should head over to CBM8bit.com. And we've actually got a URL that will be in the show notes specifically for the Amiga search.
And slash Amiga slash search or something like that,
Yeah, it's interesting. There have been times where I've been poking around looking for Amiga stuff, and I just didn't know the Amiga community as well as I did the 8-bit community. Sometimes I found it a little difficult to go search for this stuff, so I'm actually kind of glad that they've added this on their search engine. So that's what we just wanted to throw a resource at you. And if you're interested in Commodore Amiga, either the real hardware or in emulation using something like the Amiga Forever stuff, then head on over there. But Carrington, I'm more interested actually in the Twiggy Mac.
I'm bringing it right back to Apple. You know your Commodore news. I'm bringing it right back to Apple.
Because those floppy disks look weird. Talk to me about that.
So the Twiggy Mac, everybody knows. Well, our listeners all definitely know. 1984, Steve Jobs gets up, unveils the Macintosh, little toaster-sized thing that I think found its ultimate form in the SE30, my favorite of those format. But there's the original Mac comes out, and like here it is before the Mac. Before the fat Mac, before anything, just here's the Macintosh. And, of course, people who know that form factor would know that it ran off a 3.5-inch floppy drive. You put it in front, and there's your 400K 3.5-inch micro floppy drive.
Broke up a little bit. Say that last sentence again.
I've broken up with you. Earl. So
it's hard to do.
The Mac debuted with a 3.5-inch floppy drive. Most people know that. You see the image. That's how they sold. But just 6 months or so before that, the plan was the Mac was going to be released with something called a Twiggy drive, which is basically a big 5 1/4 inch drive in the front. And so you have to imagine like the original Mac, but instead of that slot for the 3 1/2 inch, it's got a big thin one for the 5 1/4 inch drive. And that drive was the Twiggy drive. And I think it's actually named after Twiggy, the supermodel. So it's a little thin drive. And so it's that is one of the rarest things, like to find a Twiggy. I've never actually seen one, but I know
because they were only prototypes.
Yeah.
I think.
Oh yeah, sure. Definitely nothing that was ever sold, but I think probably Tony Diaz has one because he's got one of everything ever made. So probably one exists and he owns it. That's probably how this goes. So the Twiggy Mac was just 5 1/4 inch drive for the Macintosh. Well, recently, in fact, just very recently, last week, the Apple's Mac development team, the original Mac development team, two of which I met wasn't really part of the Mac development team, one of which, Randy Wigginton, I met at Kansas Fest, and others.
Andy Hertzfeld,
Ron Nicholson, Jerry Manick. Dan Kottke would be, yep. Gabriel Franklin. Anyway, a bunch of them got together with Steve Wozniak and booted up a Twiggy Macintosh, which I think, according to news reports, actually booted. So there's a great article, a write-up, and lots of photos, like 20 or 30 photos from the event on cnet.com. So we'll have a link to that. That's my favorite write-up of it. And gives you the background of it. So it's great photos of everyone gathered around, and you sort of see their smiles and you know, booting up with and playing with a Twiggy Mac. So it's exciting and rare piece of kit.
Fun. Totally. Fun. And videos, did you say? Because I didn't see a...
I think just pictures, sorry.
Just pictures. Oh.
But okay. if you flip Darn. Back and forth really quickly.
Yeah, it looks like a video.
Do that with a lot trick. Of jump cuts.
Yeah, flip card kind of. Yeah, cool.
Exactly.
Cool.
So I'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. It's a really interesting looking Mac. Like it's something if you know the old Macs and you see the Twiggy, like right away you'll be like, what's wrong with this?
There's
something
weird.
Like, hold on. The floppy drive looks too big. Like it's just too, so it just immediately, you know, it's like, what's going on with this Mac? It's very cool.
Well, I do know the old Macs, and I'll talk a little bit about that at the end of the show when I talk about my stuff. But right now I'm going to talk about S100. So in my garage, I have a couple of S100 chassis. They're empty. Right. I mean, I think maybe I got a memory card and a floppy disk controller or something like that. But by and large, they're just sitting there. And later today, I may actually go out and do a little clean out of them. But the question is, what am I going to do with them? It's just the power supply and the S100 backplane. That's it. And it's actually the IEEE 696 compatible S100 backplane, which in human speak means it's the cool 16-bit capable type of backplane.
Human speak.
Yeah. Now, what would you do if you have an S100 system in a backplane and nothing to put in it? Well, I'm going to tell you what you would do.
Tell me, Earl.
You would go to www.s100computers.com and you would check out some of the cool stuff that they've constantly got brewing over there in their den of projects.
Their den of projects.
For one thing, right now, unless they're all sold out, which is possible, they've got some S100 6502 CPU boards available.
Cool.
Which you could get and write software for and have fun with. Also,
my favorite chip ever.
They've come to production status and are accepting pre-orders for some 80286 CPU boards for the S100.
Cool chip.
And as well as accepting some pre-orders for what they're calling a buffered prototyping board for the S100, which I haven't read the details about, but from the name I'm imagining it's a board that has some glue logic that eases your integration of chips and such to the S100 bus, and also gives you some prototyping room so you could solder stuff on. That's my guess.
Cool.
But if you were interested in it, you would go to S100computers.com and you would check it out. And Andrew Lynch and his various gang of folks who engineer these things, I just, hats off to these guys. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's 2013, and they're building S100 stuff like it's going out of fashion.
It is going out of fashion.
It is, in fact, going out of fashion. But they're still building stuff for it, and really cool stuff. I think I was reading recently about advances that they'd made on their 68,000 series of boards. So whatever is your chip of choice, just go over there and build an S100 system and amaze your friends. Now, the chassis and the backplanes that I have are kind of interesting because they used to house Alpha Micro S100 stuff. And some of the Alpha Micro boards were really tall, taller than the standard. So these chassis are gigantic. I mean, it's like a hernia trying to get these things up onto the workbench. But it's nice because there's plenty of room. So if I ever wanted to build one of these suckers, I should do it. I should really do it. These boards are typically only $20. Now, that's just the bare board.
Right.
You got to go out and buy all the components, and you got to solder it together, and it's not trivial. This is not, as I've mentioned before about their projects, this is not for the faint of heart. If this is your first time picking up a soldering iron, you...
Then dive in.
You might think twice about it.
Maybe. But,
anyway, so if you want something pre-assembled and that does really cool things for your Apple II, what would you buy, Carrington?
Well, in my opinion, the most exciting bit of hardware to come out for the Apple II in...
Ever?
Like maybe the best, probably the best card to ever come out for the Apple II, like ever, is the CFFA 3000. I mean, just people who haven't know how amazing it is. And basically what it does is let you... It's a card that takes a CF card, also has a USB port. You can plug stuff in. It'll mount virtual disks. So immediately the billions of disk images out on the net, just suddenly you can mount them all and play with them. You can write to stuff. You can have big collections of them on a CF card and swap and use these little remotes to mount different versions of it. It's a great way to take your existing disks and archive them. It's just like it does everything. It's something that is just mind-blowingly amazing. And if it had come out, you know, 25 years ago, then it would just be... Well, to be honest, Rich Dreher would be like a billionaire because it's like the best thing that's ever made.
We didn't have really either USB or compact flash.
He would have then invented both of those, and you can imagine like the licensing alone would have. So
that
anyway,
and transparent aluminum.
He the only been. Thing that's not amazing about a CFFA card is you can't get one. Like they're just like they all sold out and they're just gone. But right now, limited time offer, folks. There is a third. I guess this is the third run of boards. So if you missed out before, or like me, just can't get enough of these things and want to get another one, there will be another run, 575 boards. Now, every time there's been a run previously, they have sold out. So this is a run, don't walk time, and it's been up for a few days. So if you haven't ordered yet, you should immediately upon hearing this run out there. So
TikTok,
go to shop.dreher.com. So shop.dreher.net, sorry, not .com, or just do a Google search for CFFA 3000 and you'll find your way to the store. Pre-orders are in right now. They release them about 25 a week. There'll be 575 total, and they're released in first come or first purchased, first served order. So you can even see like what order you're in, so you'll know when
Did
you're
going to
get
Did you say 575 are going to be
575, yeah. So it's a big run, but they will no doubt sell out. This always sells out. Because
it's
everybody with one says
very,
that's
very
so
popular
amazing.
Product, yep.
You just get another one. I have two of them. I'm considering picking up a third. It's so mm-hmm. amazing that there's no reason not to have more of them.
Now, what will one of them set you back?
$150. And honestly, it's limited to two per household because, frankly, it's such a bargain for what it is. Mm-hmm. It is just the most useful, most amazing piece of kit. It's another $20 if you want to get – there's this CFFA remote. It's like a little daughter card. It plugs in, and then you can have a remote outside the case with two little buttons that let you cycle between what's mounted. Also totally worth it. So in my opinion, it's $170 because you should get both of those.
And go for really, the gold.
Yeah, totally, absolutely. But the $170 you invest in that will pay off immeasurably in increasing the use and longevity of any Apple II. Any Apple II with a slot, this is going to work in, I think. Yeah, I think they work off the original Apple IIs. Definitely off anything enhanced. So the 2 plus with the enhanced chip, anything with the 2E, I've got it in a regular 2E and I think an enhanced. So anyway, get it anyway. Change your Apple II if you need to. it's so good. So good. I can't express what an amazing piece of hardware it is. And the only downside is, like I said, you normally can't get them. So limited time, run, don't walk, go pick yourself up the most amazing Apple II thing ever.
Awesome.
There's also a CFFA, the original CFFA, the CFFA 1 is for the Apple 1. So if you... And it's less expensive. It's, I think it's 100, 110 or something like that. So if you want the equivalent thing but without the USB and you want it to work on it'll work on the original Apple One if you happen to have one. It also works on the Replica One. It works on the Mimio. So it works on anything that's a real Apple One type board. So making those more useful too. So buy everything Rich Dreher has for sale and your life will be better.
Cool.
You can bring back to Commodore, aren't you?
Not really.
Okay.
Not really. I'm going to talk about CPM for a second.
Oh, then that's okay.
So I've been tumbling down the rabbit hole with the language Forth.
Right.
And like learning different human languages teaches you a different way to think about things, I obviously learning different computer languages, especially ones that are weird compared to the ones that you've learned in the past. And I would say Forth counts in that category.
Sure. There's a few languages which in my mind stand out as Prolog when I learned that. Like that just it's like, okay, this is a different way of literally thinking about computers thinking. And Forth stands out because when you go from C to C++ to Oopsie to Objective-C, they're all kind of C with, fringe. Whereas Basic stood out as being different than that. Forth stands out as being different. And so I agree completely.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody wanted to learn weird languages, ones that are that give you a different paradigm of thinking about computer programming, I would say Lisp, Prolog, I would put on there.
Lisp, definitely. Yeah.
I would say Forth, definitely. And there was one other that I was thinking of. But
the first language I learned that you drag everything together, there's one that's like inherently a graphical language. The programming of it, not like Logo, though Logo also would be a different language. I think they teach you to think in terms of spatial geometry. But there's a few that jump out, yeah.
So anyway, specifically, there's a program called DXForth. And I haven't tried it yet, but I read about it in the Google groups, and it sounds interesting. And the 4.0 version just came out. Again, people doing such amazing things with old computers all the time. It just seems like it gets more exciting every month. So I will have a link to this up in the show notes. You can go check out the DXForth page. Actually, cool. The link that I'll put is for the Google group posting about this, and then you can go over to the fellow's page and check out all of the stuff that he's got over there. There's a DXForth for DOS, also DOS 2 and above. But yeah, Forth, backwards everything it does. So,
yes.
So yes.
Do you know about the Code Academy?
Yes, I do.
Code Academy is, because you're just thinking like, learning languages. I have been pointing people for a while now to Code Academy. So if any of our listeners currently aren't software developer or don't write programs and would like to learn, or you know a bit but you'd like to learn more, my favorite way on the internet at the moment to tell people here's where to go to learn is Code Academy. So it's just codeacademy.com. And it's fantastic because it can teach you, it starts with, I think, HTML, but it'll teach PHP, Python, Ruby, and JavaScript at the moment, but they seem to be, bringing more things in. So it's very much online sort of development, which makes sense because it's a website. But it has this thing where you make a little account and it'll say like, okay, do you want to learn something today? Like we know what you've gone through and here's what we suggest, do this. Oh, look, you've now made a website and here's how. And so it can take people from complete first principles through the idea of now three different programming languages and the difference between them. And it's a fantastic interactive site, just amazing, amazingly hand-holding to walk beginners through how to learn, like take those first steps to programming. So really effective. I've had a number of young people I've pointed at Code Academy, all of whom now can like knock out Ruby scripts and stuff. So very cool.
Which is nice because, like you say, it's so interactive.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually walking you through the process of learning how to do things in an environment where you can see the results of what you do. It's just, it's so much fun.
And it remembers you. What I like to make a little count and you come back and they'll say, oh, welcome back. Welcome back, Johnny. Here's where you left, lost, or, would you like to learn Ruby today? And here's where, it's really good, yeah.
Yep, completely agreed.
In a world of fun and fantasy, and ever-changing views, and computer terminology, Commodore News. Are you keeping up with the Commodore? 'Cause the Commodore is keeping up with you. Are you keeping up with the Commodore? 'Cause the Commodore is keeping up with you. Are you keeping up? 'Cause the Commodore.
making moves in a world that's full of make-believe and changing attitudes. Are you keeping up with the Commodore? 'Cause the Commodore is keeping up with you. Are you keeping up with the Commodore? 'Cause the Commodore is keeping up with you.
So let me talk about upcoming events, and I'm going to blast through these pretty quickly because we talked about them in the last show, and we'll talk about them in the next show.
But I think we have a new one to add.
We do. So Vintage Computer Festival Midwest 8.0, you'll find that happening pretty quick here, just a couple weeks, September 28th and 29th in Lombard, Illinois.
Not far from where I was this weekend.
That's true.
I could go back.
And Retropalooza, September 28th in Arlington, Texas. And I think Michael had said, wow, that's cool. Because he's in that area, isn't he?
Perfect.
And Vintage Computing Festival Europe, 14.0.
14. Still can't get my head around the
that.
That
is just so cool.
Yeah.
October 5th and 6th in Winterthur, Switzerland?
Switzerland, yeah.
Yeah, you put the CH on there and threw me.
Oh, I'm so international.
I'm so bad with geography.
It's my shipping background.
Yes.
I spent a couple of years helping at a shipping company and setting up software and doing shipping things. So because of that, I got good with the way local countries refer to themselves.
Nice. Also, another one that I put in here, the Portland Retro Gaming Expo, October 5th and 6th. I've been to this a couple times.
Are you going to go again?
I am thinking about it. I'm not committing right now.
No, you just committed.
I'm just so uncommittal. Is that even a word?
No.
Can I be uncommittal?
You can be. You can be uncommittal.
But it's in my hometown, and retrogamingexpo.com.
So you have really no excuse.
I know. It's just like 15 minutes for me.
Except for your fear of commitment.
Right. Deck Legacy 2013, October 19th and 20th at Marchese Center, Windermere? The UK, and just added Syntax Demo Part, which I imagine is a demo party.
Oh, I think it is a demo party, yes.
November 9th and 10th, 2013, in North Melbourne, Australia. And we'll have a link for that, www.syntaxparty.org. Which, by the way, I come from the .com era. I worked for a .com. It bugs people sometimes when I go www instead of www. They think
what
I'm trying to...
What bothers me is www is supposed to be an abbreviation for World Wide Web, but it's more syllables to say www than just say World Wide Web. So it's the worst abbreviation ever.
Oh, my gosh. I never thought about it that
yeah.
way. You, sir, are a man of concision.
Yes, you are a man of non-committalness.
I am.
Non-committalosity.
I am a man who's making up words today. And here I'm going to make up an idea. I'm going to talk about what I think you should get your favorite retro geek.
That would be you. What can I buy you, Earl?
You can buy me a gift card for Amazon.
I will buy you one. Hold on. There, I have bought it for you. Oh, I shipped
nice.
It to myself.
You're so
what a shame. I'll spend it in your honor.
Well, spend it well.
I will.
And here's how you can. I want to give a tip to our retro listeners. If you're looking for a retro book, a particular retro book, or just in general something for your favorite retro platform, you may be tempted to look on eBay. So go ahead, but when you do, if you find a book you're interested in, don't click that buy it now just quite yet. Go over to Amazon and see whether or not one of the plethora of used booksellers over on Amazon actually has it for much less than what the person on eBay is trying to get it for. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely, 100%, yes. And that's a nice thing about Amazon is you can think of it as like for the longest time, would still think of it as like a single storefront. Like Amazon is selling books. But Amazon is a great portal to find tons of resellers who sell through Amazon because they really got that whole one-click buying thing down, and it's just their front end. So it's a fantastic – Amazon and Abe Books, ABEbooks.com are the two sites that I go to. But yeah, as far as I can tell, you can't get Abe Books gift certificates. So – if you're buying somebody something, the way to go is definitely through the Amazon gift card.
So, I mean, for $5-6, there's a bunch of retro books that you can buy there. And the majority of that money is actually shipping.
Yeah. Yeah,
so,
often, it's crazy. All the time I'll go and I'll find amazing used books and it'll be $2 for the book and then $5 for shipping. But then I'll just buy a bunch of books and it's still $5 for shipping. So.
And of course, if you get somebody a $10 or $15 Amazon card and they don't want to use it on retro books, you know, shame on them.
Yeah, but you're not their friend anymore.
So. Yeah, that's right. But if they don't want to, there's always all the other stuff that Amazon's got, books, music, you know, videos, all kinds of things.
A friend of mine is going to be working. I have a few friends who have interesting lifestyles. I got a friend who lives on a sailboat that he built. I have a friend who sold, two of them, they sold their house 2 years ago to live full-time in an RV. They bought this big RV, and they decided, they're like early 40s, and they said, that's it, we're done, we're retiring, we're traveling to America. Like,
nice.
You're done already? And that's all.
How do you do that exactly? Because
I'd
like to
do that. One of the ways they do it is they work for Amazon. So I guess Amazon has this thing where they hire for, like, you start in September, or they want you to start right before American Thanksgiving, so I guess that's October. But they bring you on end of September, and you work through to the end of December. So you're going to work right through Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And if you live in an RV, and for any of our listeners who listen in RVs, you should know about this. It's crazy. They're hiring right now, and you take your RV, and Amazon at these three large warehouses has huge RV parks they have now built that they own, at least of two of the three, and then I think one they farm it out. They put you up there for free. So you park your RV for free, and you get free unlimited like electricity and power and sewer and all the stuff I guess you got to pay for normally. And then you work, you go across the street and you're working for Amazon like 40 hours a week in these 10-hour shifts, and they pay you. So you get like sort of free board for you and your RV, weirdly, and free Wi-Fi, and you work 40 hours a week as a picker. Like that's how Amazon's got these massive warehouses. And instead of keeping the staff all the time, I always assumed it's all pulled by robots. No, everything in Amazon is in these bins, and your order comes in, it gets printed out, and a dudette who lives in an RV takes that piece of paper and scurries all over the warehouse and picks up all your stuff and puts it in a basket, and then it gets shipped out. Like, that's how Amazon works behind the scenes.
Wow.
Is that crazy? I have no idea.
Well, I mean, some of the stuff wouldn't lend itself to robotic arm.
Well, and it's more that they need it during that Christmas and pre-Christmas crazy rush between Thanksgiving mm-hmm. and New Year's. Like that's, so they need all this new staff, but only for this, they basically need migrant workers, and that's how they're doing it. So they get a migrant
RV workers.
Basically RV workers, and you go in,
wow.
and so you end up making like $10,000, and also it doesn't cost you anything to live. So my friends who live in their RV say, no, this is what they do for their income, because it costs them about 10 grand to live a year. I'm like, that's it. I'm like, how do you live on 10,000 a year? But whatever. And so they work for these 2.5 months, and then they live by just driving around to wherever the weather's nice. Anyway, I've got nomadic friends, and so they've been telling me all about Amazon.
I honestly think that's really cool.
Isn't it? They have a very interesting lifestyle. So anyway, that's an Amazon thing as well. Your gift card goes to support my friends.
I like it. Now I'm going to buy two.
Excellent. Excellent.
All right. The other thing that I might buy, and I'll tell you why in a little bit, but I'm going to talk about my eBay auction.
Ooh, hit me.
So my eBay auction is an Apple thing.
Well done, you. Congratulations.
Jumping out of character here, but this thing just looks so interesting. It's called a Microsoft Mac Enhancer. Mm-hmm. And who better to enhance something Apple than Microsoft?
Exactly. Yes, okay.
So what you get with this thing, though, is a parallel port and a couple of serial ports. So let's say that you're looking at your Apple, and you're going, wow, I got an Epson printer. How do I plug that in? Mm-hmm. You look at the back of your old Macintosh, and you go, I don't see a plug, man. Well, what you do is you buy one of these. And there's one bid on this one. There's actually a couple that I saw up for sale. The one bid here is for $9.99, and I guess calculate shipping. I haven't clicked on that, but it's in Seattle, so probably cheap to me. And this thing gives you extra ports.
I never even heard of this thing before.
I hadn't either.
And
that's why
looks like it's for the original Macs, like for the old Macs we were just talking about. It would probably work on a Twiggy Mac.
And it would probably work on the Mac Pluses that I rescued yesterday.
This is sweet. So you're right. Like if you've got like, Okidata things and like all these printers.
Now, of course, your print drivers might not work because the Apple software will be going, hey, where's my image writer? Give me my image writer.
Unless this just converts it over and you write to it as if it's an image writer.
I'm not sure it's that smart. I mean, it's a Mac Enhancer, but,
Well, it works with the Epson MX80, which is a printer I owned and loved. So.
Which would mean it would probably, because Epson was extremely consistent.
On the FX80, sure. I had that too.
Yeah, I've got an 85 sitting here, and it speaks the same language as the MX.
Sweet. Nice. So, anyway. This is really cool for $10. That's crazy.
I know.
For me, it's $42 shipping, but I'm in Canada.
Ouch. That's got to hurt.
Well, the reality is, though, if you're selling something on eBay and you say, hey, it'll ship around the world, then eBay has built into it a thing that will calculate for you, like the cost of shipping to places. Mm-hmm. And for Canada, it overcalculates like crazy. So I find in general, if I was to buy this and pay for it, PayPal will charge me the $42 for shipping. But 19 times out of 20, then the buyer goes and refunds me, you know, $28. It only cost me $10 to ship. So almost always the buyers will then just refund it. So because it's
very cool.
It doesn't nearly cost that much to ship something as small to Canada. This is really cool. I've never even known about this. This is a very cool item that you found.
So I had a Mac thing, and in extreme contrast to that, you have
a Mac thing.
So tell us about your Mac thing.
Nothing if not consistent. My Mac thing is my favorite. One of my favorite Macs. It depends on the day which will my favorite. When we're talking old school Macs, there's a few models that I adore, and I've talked about them on previous episodes. Like there
the
is the SE30.
Cool.
I love the SE30, but when it comes to the Quadras and the LC form factor, there's a particular one that I think is heads and tails of beyond everything else, and it's the LC475, which is the same as the Quadra 605, and they don't come up that often. Because they're such a phenomenal computer. Like, they're just so much better than the other LCs. The difference between like the LC 1, 2, and 3, and then the 475, it's a big jump. It's also sort of your best and fastest option if you want to use an Apple IIe card. They'll fit it. So it's got the
they'll
CS
fit in
slot.
This Quadra?
Exactly. So with a Quadra 605, nice. You can get a 2E card. Like, that's what I use. So I've got a 2E card, and I've got it in my LC475, which is the same computer as the Quadra 605. And that becomes an amazing combination because it's a really fat, if you're going to run like System 6 or System 7 on these, it's a crazy, zippy, amazingly quick computer for running that era of Mac software. And this will run the nice big color monitor for running your Apple II, and you with the Apple IIe card, you can plug in the 5 1/4 inch drives. You can take screenshots. It's really easy to transfer stuff back and forth. Now, yes, a CFFA 3000 is even easier. It's awesome, but this is a great way to like network these things, and just it's amazing. I love my LC475, and often these come up on eBay, and it'll be like $400 or something that I consider ridiculous for this kind of kit. So it's one at the moment, $75. Still 2 days left. It's got one bid. Up until not too long ago, I had no bids. I thought someone's going to get themselves a steal. So this person who's just bid might get themselves a steal for just $75, mm-hmm. and you get a Quadra 605 with a keyboard, and they're throwing in a Mac StyleWriter, an Apple StyleWriter printer.
So, I saw that.
Yeah, don't really care about the printer so much. It was a decent printer, I guess, but whatever. It's a bubble jet with a fancy front on it. But the Quadra 605 is a really nice computer, and here's one you can pick up for just $75. So.
And did they have any indication here whether it was working?
Macs always work.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, good.
This person just says that it worked. It's the old, it worked when I put it away, but it powers on. And what I would want to ask the guy is, what noise does it make when it powers on? What kind of bing do you get? Do you get just a single bing, or do you get the elevator chimes of doom? So if you don't get the elevator chimes of doom, you're probably okay. Right? So
gotcha.
For $75, come on. Take a chance. What I was going to pick, and if we had recorded last week, this is what I would have picked, is there was, up until yesterday, a 1979 Challenger. So from Ohio Scientific, not a computer you see come up much.
So no. And the big old drives, Apple, was it a 4P, the Challenger?
Big drives, yes. It was like Andy's cue. It was 4P, and it's got two floppy drives. But the floppy drives are the size of other people's computers, like these massive, massive floppy drives. And a great-looking case with a great-looking keyboard. it was a starting bid of $999, and it actually got two bids. So it sold for $1,125, so quite a bit of money. But I've never seen one of these things come up. Like, I wasn't even sure what it was at first. I was like, what is this? So it's the Challenger 4P. I'll make sure we have a link in the show notes just because it's a really pretty computer, great form factor. It's something you just don't see. So I'll make sure we have a link to that in the show notes as well.
Cool.
Yeah.
Hey, before we swing out to the closing stuff, we have comments, and I'm falling down on the job here.
Job faller downer.
Yesterbits mentioned, it's been fun regarding our video, but we'll still try and figure out how to do live events sometimes.
Absolutely, yes. I would love to be able to do it live audio only.
Right.
And it's so hard to find a decent solution. Many of our listeners, especially our live listeners, if you want us to do a live thing, we're just really struggling with the video stuff, and the infrastructure to do the video has become just more effort than it's worth. But I would be totally up for being able to broadcast our stream live. There's a few options, but they seem finicky and expensive. So if there's a really good free version, let us know.
Yeah, that's what we're looking for.
Or just everyone will have to join us on Skype.
We love the interaction.
We
really like that. It's just the, we covered. The video stuff has just kind of been difficult. So Yesterbits also mentioned that there was at least one Twiggy drive at Kansas Fest, and yes, it was Tony's. So you were correct.
When in doubt, of course. I think Tony has at least one, if not two, of everything, including things that don't exist.
Yes.
He has them just in case they later do exist.
The magical unicorn.
Crazy what that guy has. And the knowledge he has. It really is almost insufferable. He's so knowledgeable. it's amazing. Like, you cannot trip this guy up. He just has the most incredible depth of. It's not just like, you know, a lot of people, like, I know a lot of things about a few things. Tony knows a lot of things about a lot of things. It's crazy. You can come to him with the most obscure Apple II related topic in any piece of weird, obscure, this thing only existed just in a certain part of the Ukraine in a given week in September of 1978. He'll say, I've got the schematic in my pocket. I happen to have it, and I've got it memorized, and I improved on it. It's crazy what that guy knows. I'm actually just kind of jealous of what I am.
Which is really cool, though.
Nice
to have somebody like that so plugged in to the community.
It is great. He is such an asset to the community. It's crazy what an asset to the community is. Just having that knowledge, be able to say, no, this is how that worked. And I have, over the years now, asked him a ton of questions, and he has never failed to steer me right. It's as far as I know. been fantastic. Yeah.
That Twiggy was his. And Michael says, don't give up completely on the Arduino, Carrington.
I already did.
Turn hardware problems into software problems also.
Oh.
But you know what, Michael? We don't want problems. We want solutions. That's what my manager always tells me.
I kind of like problems.
Oh, okay. I like them, too.
Challenges.
Okay, fine.
It's just the Raspberry Pi right now is what's appealing to me because it is so software-based. I've been looking for an excuse to get much deeper into Linux.
Do you actually have one?
No.
You should get one.
I know, but they used to be really hard to get, and I got really
frustrated. Yeah, they're not hard to get now.
I know, but I got so
frustrated. And I got my nice little transparent case.
I like your case.
With a little raspberry on the top.
Where'd you get your case from?
On eBay, $5 or something like that. Nice. I don't remember what it was.
I got to get a 3D printer, and then I'll print my own case. I want a 3D printer so badly.
I'm pretty sure that the person who did this just did it with a laser cutter or something.
I want to get a laser as well.
Yeah, well, laser would be nice. I've always wanted a laser. Lasers and sharks for some reason. And Michael agrees. If you order the CFFA 3000, be sure to get that remote disk swap button.
Yeah, I didn't get it for the first one I got. And I think it's either it didn't exist right away or something. There was some weird thing because I jumped on the first orders of the first one. But the second one I bought with the remote, and I have found it incredibly useful. So it's really, really good for $20. Adds a lot of use to the CFFA 3000.
Yesterbits says, I presume that any RV-bound vintage computer collections are mainly focusing on calculators.
Yes, or a lot of Portal. You know, the thing is, I think so much in terms of that. Like, when I was talking to my friends, and I was asking them, how do you two, because they're into, like, tech as well. I'm like, how's your Wi-Fi, though? I can totally see the appeal of the nomadic lifestyle, but I'm like, but how do you get on the internet? My life would be empty.
How would you have the Wi-Fis?
That's what keeps me out of it.
I mean, maybe you'd go to RV parks that had it.
No, they say it's terrible. They basically have a cell connection thing, and they just pay a big bill.
I think they're kind of independently doing okay money-wise, because I'm like, how are you having this lifestyle? It's crazy.
Yeah. Huh. Yep. Well, all right. So we're going to talk now about chess.
Chess, I shall destroy you. In the forum over at vintage-computer.com, somebody else started up a thread about it. And there's only one post so far saying, hey, this is coming up. And that guy, can't remember his name, suggested that I don't use Chessmaster 2000. So I have two shrink-wrapped pieces of software. I've got Sargon 3 and Chessmaster 2000. Of course, I couldn't use anything, but I love the idea of opening up a vintage piece of Apple II software and fulfilling its destiny, and the destiny is to destroy you and your Commodore. You're the Commodore menace. But he says that the Chessmaster 2000 was specifically designed to make people feel good about themselves, and it was like an easy-to-beat chess game and stuff, and it's more of a beginner thing. So that looks like a bad choice. So I might change my choice and go with my Sargon 3, because I've got one of those shrink-wrapped as well, and I could open that up. But unfortunately, you've chosen a piece of software that beat Sargon 3 already in a tournament. So I worry.
That doesn't mean it'll beat it again.
And you did beat the Commodore version, so it doesn't necessarily mean... And I get first move. So
you do. And first move is an advantage when you're talking about an automated game like this.
Yeah.
So, but in there's some more... I actually responded to a couple of the things over on that thread.
You.
And in the subsequent conversation, people were saying, how are you going to do it? You're going to limit it on time. And I answered, yes, that was our thought. Is it going to be on emulators or the real thing? Of course.
Real hardware.
Real thing.
Yes, I'll do it on a 1 megahertz. I've got this Apple IIe here. This will be my champion right here.
It'll be one versus one in terms of megahertz. And also, we'll try and do the split screen video.
Sure.
And we will tweet it out in terms of official chess notation, which means I'm going to have to refresh my memory on my official chess notation. I knew it
at
one point.
And I will send my notes to you like left horsey, up one, over two. You can change it.
Give it to me in, don't use Cartesian coordinates. Use,
pointy hat guy.
Give me
diagonally.
Give me GPS. GPS coordinates. That'll do.
How big is this chess match?
Anyway, yes, some of those things we will work out, and we're going to try and do this pretty soon.
Yeah, very soon. I mean, I'd love to get it done before the next episode, in the next 2 weeks if possible. It'd be great. Why not? I've got video. We got the internet. I want to, we'll definitely make sure that we tell people in advance, because it's something that I'd like people to be able to follow along with live.
Yes. Yeah. So maybe in a day or two, you and I should hook up offline, and we'll figure out how to do that. But you have one other thing you wanted to mention, a blog.
I do? Oh, yes. I ran across, I don't know how, like every once in a while you stumble across something, and this was such a good blog that I thought it was worth, maybe everybody knows about this. There's a guy named Ken Shiriff, Shirriff, like sheriff, but with just eyes. So Ken Shiriff, and he has this blog all about, he says it's about chargers, microprocessors, Arduino, and whatever. I found it because he has this most recent post, which is from a few weeks ago, all about the Z80, and has this 4-bit ALU. And
did you mean a Z80?
Nope, I meant a Z80. But he says the Z80 has a 4-bit ALU, and here's how it works. And he goes into this crazy detail about how this works, and including, like, here's an X-ray of the chip, and here's where the bits are.
Oh, my goodness, I'm looking at this now.
Like, exactly. Then he'll say, like, here's how the ALU works, and here's the logic flow through it, and, like, describes it in crazy, if you want to make one yourself, detail. Like, it just, and here's the core computational circuit X-rayed, and here's, like, just, and he, this is just one post. All his posts are like this, and stuff about the 6502, and stuff about Arduino things to calculate, just crazy. And I don't know if everybody knows about this guy, and it just was news to me, but I
didn't know about it.
Blown away by this blog.
I'm going to spend a lot of time here.
Absolutely. So we will link to it. It's weird. It's righto.com. It looks like R-I-G-H-T-T-O. Righto. Righto.
One T. Righto, then.
Righto.com. So it's Ken Shiriff's blog, and he deserves a vast readership. I was crazily impressed by the depth and the detail and the breadth of knowledge, and just what an archive, what a resource. Amazing blog, and really easy to follow. just I went down this rat hole of just reading his stuff. Goes back to 2008, and it's just amazing. And so we'll have a link to it in the show notes. I was very, very impressed by this guy.
See, I thought about taking a Z80 microscope, imaging it, yes, and reverse engineering the logic. But then I realized that what?
Right, exactly. Yes, no, but
there's no way I could do that.
Yeah, and it's just it's amazing. And he goes through the whole computational logic in like detail. Here's what this does, and then he says, and here's how this differs from the 6502. And I was just like, just amazing stuff. I'm like, how, what? It's just crazy. I mean, and not just on one topic, on a bunch of topics.
So. Other than the fact that your, you know, typical retro enthusiast wouldn't have a microscopic imaging system and wouldn't be able to reverse engineer the logic and wouldn't understand what any of this means, other than that, it's kind of trivial.
Sure, yes. Other than that. but he's got things about like, tips on doing something particular with an oscilloscope. And he's got stuff about, it's hardcore, cool, techie science stuff. It's like these are the people when you're really young and you'd go to Radio Shack and people you would look up to would be doing and buying and just talking the most amazing stuff. This is that guy. This is this, you know, I imagine he's got a big beard. I hope he's well bearded, because it's just something, just he reverse engineers chip things and just it's amazing. Just an amazing and impressive blog.
Here's an interesting quote from a posting. Intel x86 documentation has more pages than the 6502 has transistors.
See, that kind of stuff. So, just anyway, I don't know who he is and what his background is, but I am impressed by him.
Yes, I will be doing a lot of reading over here.
So, righto.com.
And so I'll just talk briefly about my rescue. So a friend of mine called me, and ironically, while I was at a Commodore meeting here in town. And he said, hey, I was at a garage sale and these folks had some old Macintoshes and they were trying to sell them, but they couldn't sell them, so they were just going to like throw them away. So I took them. And I...
That's always a good thing to do, because even if you're just going to find a home someplace, I hate it when something's going to get thrown out. A few times I have grabbed things and basically just held on to them for a while, because if you can post into the right community, have got this stuff, it's available for free, you can generally find a home for things.
Oh, so, and the old classic Macs are very desirable. Mm-hmm. Lots of people want to get their hands on those. Sure. So what I wound up with is a Mac 512 and three Mac Pluses.
Wow, cool. Especially the 512, the Fat Mac. Nice.
Only one keyboard, no mouse.
Okay. Easy to come by, though.
Yeah, I might have to try and find a, you know, it's a little, I think, 9-pin
the telephone plug,
connector,
exactly.
Mouse. The keyboard has...
The telephone will work, though. You can plug in a phone, and then you just call in, and you speak E, 7, shift.
And that, no, I have a keyboard. I have a keyboard. I just don't have a mouse.
Oh, okay. You know, mouse is somewhat useful in the old Macs.
Yeah, any Mac is
remarkably useful for the Mac, yes.
Now, the cool thing is that I used to be certified as an Apple repair technician for the Mac Plus. This was more years ago.
Well, now we'll find out if you're still up to stuff.
After 25-plus years, let's see if any of those brain cells still work. But the other thing is, the old Apple service manuals were excellent. I mean, they were real books. You'd get them after a while they transitioned to CDs. But in the early days, you'd get the books and you would turn to, you know, chapter 4 doing this.
I had the books too. Yeah.
Their flow charting and their just methods of walking through how you could fix the stinking thing were very effective. And I'm hoping, fingers crossed, that those books are now somewhere available online.
I think they should be, because if I remember, I used to have those books. I used to be big fans of those and the big inside Macintosh books, like for the programmers, you can get the big one, those big sets, the ones with the black spines originally and stuff like that. So the white ones, I guess, originally. And big fans of all those things. And if I recall, the last versions I had of the tech manuals, I got on one of those, there used to be the developer CDs that would come out. And I think they included all of them as, I don't think they were PDFs though, it was some weird file format, but I'm pretty sure they got released digitally directly from Apple, which means they're going to be floating around somewhere.
Right, and that's what I'm going to be looking for. Having three Mac Pluses should dramatically increase my chances of making at least one functional.
Well, if you make two of them functional, you'd have a Mac Plus Plus, which would be an object-oriented Macintosh. And yes. That'd be, you know,
yes.
Pretty cool.
And then it would have both encapsulation and polymorphism, which right. I've always really wanted in a Macintosh.
It's just an instance of this Macintosh, yes.
So, what else? So, yeah, so I'm looking forward to opening those up. Now, it may turn out that because they're Mac Pluses, I may have to recap them.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be a pretty common thing, is that the capacitors go boom.
Yep.
And then it makes a big mess, and you got to get
the monitors get funky sometimes. So,
but again, I got three of them, so you know, cross your fingers for me. The second thing is, I've been doing a lot of work with Forth that I mentioned earlier, and mm-hmm. specifically, there was this product called Blazon Forth that in the 80s, this guy named Scott Ballantyne looked at the available Forths on the Commodore 64 and went, "Wow, I can't find anything I like." So he wrote one.
See, that's a great motivator.
And it became very popular. He gave it away for free.
I don't know it.
Well, you never heard of that.
Was it on other platforms as well?
I don't know.
Yeah, it doesn't ring a bell. I'm pretty sure I did not use that.
But the book that you... I have it here. Only people on video will see this. But what I'm holding up is a blue book that says Starting Forth.
Forth was nice for puns as well.
Yes, it's written by a guy named Leo Brody, and there are people, even one of the folks on Twitter, that when I tweeted about using this book said this was the finest work he'd ever read in computer science, period, on any topic. And as I've been going through the book, I've been finding that is really the case. This is an amazing teaching book. So the Blazon Forth product on the Commodore 64 conforms pretty well to this book. There are a couple minor differences, nice. But nothing to throw you off. And the guy who wrote the Blazon Forth even says, you know, you can use this Starting Forth book to learn this product. And so I've just been having lots of fun with that. I'm doing a series at our local Commodore group on how Blazon Forth works. And so this last, what was it, Thursday night, we're using Forth to make the SID chip do a bunch of different music. And also to make the graphics chip. It has an integrated turtle graphics in the product, so you can scroll a little turtle around. That's a mixed metaphor, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
You don't squirrel the turtle.
No, you just move the turtle.
Don't do that. That sounds terrible. Anyway, that's my deal. That's what's going on with me.
What's your deal? That is your deal. Now we know.
That is my deal.
Very cool.
And I think that's it. Is that
that's it? That's enough.
All right. Then I guess we got to pull the ripcord. All right. Then I'm going to do... that's it. We're out of here. But first I have to read the closing thing.
Hit me.
And I got to do it in my DJ voice. So that's it for this show. The next RCR will be on Sunday, September 29th.
And we'll be audio only, everybody.
Yeah, I think it'll be at the normal time, 4 p.m. Eastern and 1 p.m. Pacific, maybe. Look at rcrpodcast.com for more details on that.
Right. And if you're subscribed, the easiest way to get the audio show for anybody who does listen is to go to rcrpodcast.com and just there's a couple of links there that you can click on to subscribe. Or if you use anything to do with iTunes, you just go to iTunes and search for Retro Computing Roundtable. You'll find us, and you can subscribe in iTunes. That way you'll get all episodes automatically. So that's definitely the best
right.
way to look.
You can do it via iTunes, but if you're iTunes averse, we do have an RSS feed.
Sure, yeah. Absolutely, yes. And I'm going to try to... I've been remiss in getting our RSS feed in other podcatcher feeder
software. The pod search engines?
Exactly. So I will make sure that we're in everything I can find before the next episode.
Nice.
Yeah.
And you can find the show notes, especially the links that we talk about, at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss in the forums at vintage-computer.com/vcforum. And if you're a retro enthusiast, what's that?
Especially with the chess thing. Now that right now at that forum, they're talking about our chess match, which is going to come up soon. So if you've got ideas or suggestions on how I can womp Earl... and how I might win. I welcome those suggestions, in public or in private. I welcome them, because I am worried. I am frankly quite worried, folks. Help me. So, but if you have ideas of how we can best present the live chess match to listeners, how do you want it? Do you want a tweet-by-tweet way to follow it? Do you want us to give them their own Twitter feeds? Do you want a video that you can watch live? Do you just want to watch a sped up video after the fact? Do you want us to be discussing it? Do you want us to be live blogging? Like, what would you like? Let's make that happen. And a great way to you can send us direct feedback, or if you just go to rcrpodcast.com, you'll see a link for the forum. Go there and dive in and maybe give your suggestions in public, and we can all talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is we want this to be as fun as possible. And
definitely. That well, we want me to win.
We want it to be as fun as possible. And the Vintage Computer Forum at vintage-computer.com, if you're a retro enthusiast, you just got to be there anyway.
Oh, yeah.
That's
and it's a friendly forum. A lot of forums
are great community.
They're not crotchety. Not at all. They love being there. It's awesome.
Yeah.
It's such a friendly forum. It's probably the most friendly tech-oriented forum I have ever been on.
For any topic,
period,
since
the Genie days, it's even more than that. Like, it's crazy. Most tech-oriented forums for niche tech are not nice, and that you come in asking questions like, "Oh, you don't already know everything? We immediately hate you."
It seems like a game of stomp the newbies.
Absolutely, it's the exact opposite in this forum. It is the most welcoming forum anywhere. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, you can follow the Retro Computing Roundtable on Twitter @RCRPodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And if you do like us, and if you do, if you like us or not, whatever. But if you don't like us, tell us. If you do like us and you subscribe on iTunes, do a review on iTunes if you get the chance.
Five stars, take two seconds.
How could we possibly be any less? Exactly. Show some love.
Yes, we'll podcast for stars.
And until next time, Retro Compute.